Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you again.
Special guest on the political left, Brian King, who now chairs the state Democratic Party.
No, I don't. The election's on May 31st. I'm just one of four candidates, actually. So we'll see if I get elected.
Okay. I'm,
you know, it's me and Phil Lyman.
Okay.
Have you run a race against him before?
The name is familiar, but, you know, we'll see.
Well, love having you on, Brian. And how many years did you serve in the legislature?
16. I was elected in 2008 and served up until December 31st of 2024.
Okay.
So we served 4 years together in the House.
Nice. Okay. So we keep the good chemistry of both sides of the aisle with differing points of view, and let's go right
to... This is really when we learned to debate. You know, Brian and I would really go the rounds on the floor. And we were great friends.
Okay. Yes.
And so people were just, well, how do you get along so well?
Well, I'm guessing there's a lot on this sort of list of things to talk about that you two will agree on, because we've got a president who's now talking about, could he stay in power for a third term? I can only guess how you both feel about that. But Brian, let's let you go first
as
our guest.
Look, I mean, everybody who's dealt with Donald Trump knows it's always all about Donald. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any power or opportunity for being in control that he has shied away from or that he hasn't wanted to embrace and keep. And this is just another example of that. I fundamentally just don't think the guy believes in the principles, basic principles of our U.S. Constitution or the rule of law. It's as simple as it gets.
Yeah. Are you in any different place than that, John?
Well, I think part of this is a stunt to avoid people talking about him being a lame duck in his last term as president.
Yeah.
No, I think that's true, John.
It's no fun for highly ambitious people, accomplished people, to feel their relevancy decline.
Right.
But there's also this argument that he's just trying to distract from all the other crazy things happening right now. Most recent, just that kind of, you know, gives you pause, is you have this terrible earthquake.
Media saturation, basically.
Yeah. You have this terrible earthquake. The death toll in Burma is now over 2,000. And apparently the USAID cuts have slowed the rescue effort. And that didn't sit well with me, John.
Well, and you going over this is news to me because I hadn't even heard that in the news.
Yeah. I had an employee here at the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute who's in Thailand right now. And, you know, her family's safe. Everything's fine. But it hits closer than you think.
Yeah. And I've heard people say, well, we're putting $2 million into it. Well, that sounds like a lot of money. But when you're talking about devastation of the type that you see there in Thailand and surrounding areas, that's a drop in the bucket. They need tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And well, look, I don't think that it's solely a U.S. responsibility. It wasn't under USAID. I'm glad other countries are coming in. But this is a good example of the loss of soft power that the United States has really relied on and has benefited the United States in the past. USAID was, in essence, a huge example of soft power. And to cut it completely or as far back as the administration wants to do, I think hurts the United States globally.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things I would prefer is soft power that's not resident with the federal government. You know, it's just everyday Americans teaming together to help out those in need around the
citizen
world.
Citizen diplomacy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Rather than, hey, the government should do this, the government should do that.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that. The challenge, of course, is, especially when you're talking about a global crisis, what other organizations are there that can really bring to bear their resources? Now, there are some, like Catholic
Relief. Today we're in a much better position to do that than 100 years ago.
Yeah, the Catholic Relief Services, the LDS Church, a bunch of other humanitarian organizations can do a lot. But there are some things I think that the United States government has a unique role to fill, and I'd like to see it done better.
Brian, you're an attorney by training. John, you are almost finished with a law degree.
Less than 3 weeks.
What do you make of this Signal War group chat and the U.S. judge that's now ordered the public officials involved to preserve the messages? Is that how it works?
Well, I'm glad that Judge Boasberg has stepped in to say, hey, these need to be preserved. Mm-hmm. Because I don't have confidence that the administration and the people like Pete Hegseth and others who have demonstrated, from my perspective, that they're not really believers in the rule of law and they're not going to comply with statutes. Statutes and rules of law are for suckers in their mind. And so I think it's good that Judge Boasberg steps in and says something. Now, whether they're going to do what he tells them to do is another matter.
Yeah.
Part of the beauty, if you will, of Signal is, you know, you can set the messages to auto-delete, you know, 24 hours, a week later, whatever it might be. And so for all I know, these are already deleted long before the judge ever said anything.
I had heard that they were on a longer delete schedule, John, and that they hadn't been. And so,
my understanding is each person can set their own delete schedule.
Well, I don't know.
And I don't know what they set, but you would think that they set some type of quick delete.
Always an interesting week in this political climate, but we also have some elections this week that are of consequence. And if I've got the numbers right, in the U.S. House of Representatives, Republicans hold 218 seats, Democrats 213, and there's four vacant House seats. Some live fire.
So it's really close.
It's close. It's close. So close that Trump withdrew.
When is the last time the House has actually been fully occupied? There's always like a vacancy here or there.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, President Trump's nominee for the U.S. ambassador, Elise Stefanik, he's had her withdraw.
Yeah,
because
she's sitting in a seat.
It could flip.
I've heard that there were such huge margins in the two Florida seats that are voting today, that even Democrats think it's unlikely that they'll flip. But, I mean, when you're talking about a 30-plus R seat flipping down to something like the Republican wins by five, that sends a pretty strong message. And I think pulling the Stefanik nomination is an indication of concern and nervousness on the part of the administration.
Yeah.
And I would suggest it's not just this election. It's looking forward in 2 years. Because if the Democrats take control of the House, I mean, they can basically shut down a lot of what Trump's doing
and just
make his life miserable investigation after investigation.
Yeah, so then you also have the Supreme Court election in Wisconsin, and you have Elon Musk traveling
there. You got money on the line there?
He's offering out $1 million ahead of this election to voters who sign the petitions. You know, I guess some sort of random draw.
I want to hear what John, Mr. Libertarian, has to say about money in political elections. Citizens
money
United.
Money is all over political elections.
No, I know. Citizens United, how do you feel about it?
Well, money is speech. I mean, this is the nature of the beast. And part of the problem is we have put too much power in the hands of government. And thus, we cause people to engage in these type of activities to try and get more power through government. And you know me, I want to shrink government down really small. So we're fighting at the state or the local level, not at the federal level. And it's a winner-take-all kind of contest.
Isn't the influence of money pervasive in the sense that it doesn't matter whether government's too big in your mind or government's too small? If somebody wants to come in and influence an election with spending $20 million or more, as people say Elon Musk has spent in this race, is that okay?
That's the American way. Yes, absolutely. To say you can't speak in whatever way you want to speak, you know, starts to impair.
I'm not sure that money is speech. I mean, I get the connection, but
Brian, you and I can go stand on a street corner and can't influence much.
Right.
But to say somebody who's a millionaire or $10 million or a billionaire, to say you can't, you know, leverage this or that, you know, social media or the traditional media or whatever it might be to do advertising.
Citizens United troubles me in the sense that it empowers oligarchs in a way and billionaires in a way that we already see such a disparity in how much money people have. It's troubling to me in some senses.
Mm, yeah.
But we look at campaign finance laws and they're really a sham. I mean, I look at the campaign finance laws at the federal level and they're really incumbent protection acts. It's who has the network to raise, quote unquote, the small dollars, the incumbents. The upstarts can't challenge. And because of the way it's, quote unquote, transparent, it's really so the incumbent can punish anybody that steps out of line.
No, I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
But in large part, I think that's because of Citizens United. I mean,
that was before Citizens United.
I know. Money's always had a huge impact.
Your point is it's gotten worse.
Yes, it's gotten worse.
Yeah. Hey, so, you know, the middle's feeling crowded out here as you guys have all your longstanding debates.
You can listen to us continue to talk.
Well, I just would say that there's something unseemly. There's something that I just can't feel comfortable with when a billionaire is paying people money to sign petitions.
Giving away million-dollar checks. He gave away $2 million checks, Natalie, and one of them was to the chair of the Young Republicans in Wisconsin.
This is crazy. All right, you know, we'll get into our next segment shortly, but we also have Doge. And
by the way, I want to just note, Natalie wants the billionaires to donate to the Kim Gardner Institute.
I love philanthropy, no question about it. The health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., looks like they're looking to cut 10,000 more jobs. A lot of them out of the Health and Human Services Department. This is a department I worked in. It's the largest federal agency. It's where, you know, Medicare is, Medicaid is.
So how would you
CDC,
answer his
FDA.
Comment is we're spending more money and it hasn't fixed health outcomes.
Yeah.
What would you say?
Oh, I would say that the U.S. health system is a mess and needs reform. And it has nothing to do with the number of employees at HHS and everything to do.
Absolutely. But
everything to do with.
Is cutting employees at HHS really going to hurt anything?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it will.
How so?
Well, you know, so how do your payments come to you? How do you regulate quality at the hospitals? How do you help with the Indian Health Service? How do you deal with substance abuse problems and some of the grants that are given there? I mean, it's the HHS is it's our health, for crying out loud. And we want to, like, shrink it.
Yeah.
From my
perspective, the disparity in wealth and income in our country is reflected in the poor outcomes, health outcomes that we have. People who don't have money don't have the ability to get preventative care and other basic services that they need, period.
Well, and I would contend the federal government has injected itself in the healthcare system, which has driven up the cost that makes it so that poor people can't afford to get the care that they'd like to have, that they need to have, because of the inefficiencies, the ineffectiveness of the federal government. And when it comes to quality of medical care, I'm not looking at the federal government to really keep me safe. In fact, there's times where I think they do more harm than good.
Sounds consistent, John. That's my word for you today. Hey, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about local news. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
I'm John Dougal on the right.
I'm Brian King on the left.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We're missing Shireen Gorbani today, but
I never get to do the intro.
Yeah, but we have a great person coming in with us with Brian King.
Brian's a great friend.
Yeah. Brian, just since we have you, can you just give us your quick talking points on the political unrest that we feel in our world right now? I just want to ask you that before we dive into local news. I mean, how do you, what got us in this place? What's this next year going to feel like?
Yeah.
Why is it the Democrats' fault?
Yeah, I knew you'd come up with that, John. I think for a long time, for various reasons, the parties have been polarizing, and people speaking on behalf of candidates and leaders of the parties have been polarizing. Part of that is a money issue. Part of that is the way the media has developed, quite honestly.
Yeah, social media.
It's easier to be siloed than ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be.
And the economics have gone, so they've had to appeal
to their base voters and their base supporters. Yeah. So I think the more we retreat to our corners, the more we engage in either or, black and white thinking, the more we become tribal in our thinking about these things politically, the more likely it is that it's going to be tough to find middle ground. And that's what we've seen here. And I think that the one-party control now of Washington, D.C., in the sense that the executive and the legislative branches are held by the Republicans, I think Donald Trump has really ridden this horse hard of either or, you know, kind of going to war with the other side and demonizing the other side. And he's not the only one. I don't mean to be too aggressive in painting him as a bad character.
Because clearly AOC likes to reach out and build bridges.
Well, I actually do think that AOC likes to reach out more and build bridges than Donald Trump. But anyway, I think getting through this is a real challenge.
Yeah. And would you just, this is totally unfair, but going out to the midterm elections, what would you predict at this point? Do you think that the Republican right's going to be able to sustain the momentum that they had in this last presidential election? Or do you think the Democrats are going to come on strong?
I think it depends on what you see economically more than anything
Interesting.
Else. I think that the bottom line economics of how families are feeling in terms of their financial security or insecurity in the time frame from like June to October of 2026 is going to be critical.
Interesting. Brian, I want to know your thoughts. Gavin Newsom, governor of California, said something along the lines of the Democratic brand right now is toxic. Give me your thoughts.
Look, I mean, that's not particularly surprising that he would say that. I mean, I heard today that the approval rating of the Democratic Party is 29%. And so
why is that?
There's no question that Democrats.
Because I know, you know, a lot of folks are concerned with Trump. So tell me.
Part of it is that the Republicans have relentlessly and effectively demonized Democrats. But part of it is that Democrats have also not been in touch as as sensitively and specifically as they could and should have been to the desires and needs of regular working people in our state and country.
Brian's comment that this depends on the economy, we have a term for that. It's economic determinism. You know, it's this idea that how as the economy goes, so goes the elections and whatnot. One last question on this. Do you think that there is indeed a woke right? I've been hearing more, you know, we always hear about the woke left, but I'm hearing more and more that there's a woke right.
Well, there's certainly a sort of group. There's an ideology that is that people on the right want to buy into, and they expect that other tribe members on the, in the Republican Party or in the MAGA base also buy into. And when people talk about woke, I mean, that's a clever label that the right attached to people that they perceived on the left were too sensitive about things that they shouldn't be worried about, basically, and that people weren't worried about. I think that they were effective in branding certain Democrats that way, and I think that the woke right is another way of trying to brand in a negative way some of the folks who are MAGA, the MAGA-based supporters.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know if you want to comment, John, or we can go to local news. Go local.
Well, I was just, I mean, going back to, you know, the economy, you know, Trump is talking about what? 25% tariffs, not just on the few countries he listed before, but massive. And so this is when you talk about economic determinism, what's really going to happen with the economy?
Well,
I mean, if he really does control inflation and start to rein in the, you know, cost increases and it does improve the economy, well, great, it's going to look good for him. But Natalie, you and I assume Brian is probably also skeptical about, we don't believe in tariffs.
Right.
And while I want
Why
to reward—
Why is he doing this, John?
Well, I think he believes that America has been screwed over the years in terms of trade policies and so forth. And to a certain extent, he's right. I would rather entice people to come and do business here, make us the most rewarding country to do business in, rather than create these tariff barriers and basically punish us.
Yeah,
and try and use that as a tool to bring companies back.
I think it's so interesting, this notion that our trade policy has, you know, hurt us. I'm not going to use the same word you use, but hurt us.
Well, no, I'm using the words he would use.
Okay, yeah. But the key is that if we don't want these products, we don't have to buy them. We're buying them because they're cheaper, because they're of a quality we want, because they're available.
Right.
I don't know. The whole premise in economics is you only make a trade if both benefit. That's why the economy grows with trade.
And I think that's going to play a massive role in the upcoming midterms.
I do, too. And it's interesting to see the parties flip to some degree on the free trade issue. You know, it used to be that the Republicans were the free traders and the Democrats were a little more inclined to be protectionists. And now it's just completely flipped on its head.
But we flip-flopped over the centuries.
Yeah, we have.
You're right. Well, our governor, Spencer Cox, is going to be on a trade mission in Canada. I don't know if it's next week or the week after, but that's going to be an interesting experience because my understanding is if you're an American in Canada right now, they don't like you too much.
He may get a tomato or two thrown at him.
No matter how nice they are,
The nice thing, I'm not so sure they're nice anymore, John.
So, Brian, we have now passed the veto signing period.
And you didn't have a single bill vetoed.
I did not.
Congratulations. 2025 session.
Neither did I.
So the governor went ahead and signed the universal vote-by-mail election system bill.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you must have feelings about this.
Oh, my gosh. John saw the beginning of this. He left the legislature before I think it really picked up steam. But in the teens, and I can't remember when it was, whether 14 or 16 or 15, 17, right around that era, we put vote by mail in universally and we extended it. And look, I know that there has been talk about fraud and all that, and no mailing, no election system is going to be perfect, but there is very little research or evidence or data to suggest that vote by mail in Utah resulted in any meaningful levels of fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow, and I think it was based on this MAGA talking point on a national level, the leaders of the legislature persuaded, and the members of the legislature were persuaded that they should change our system. I don't know of one state, and I could be wrong about this, but I think Utah is leading out in a very bad way in the sense that we expanded the franchise to as many people as possible while ensuring that we would not have fraud in the voting system. And now we're contracting it in a way that I just don't think is good at all.
Interesting. John, the other point we've had, you've already talked a little bit about the election thing, but we have the Society of Professional Journalists who have now given Utah legislature the Black Hole Award. It's the first time that there's been a two-time winner of the Black Hole Award. It's for what happened during the session to change the state's records committee and the way that government records are made available to the public. I have a hunch, as a libertarian, small L, as you've told me before, that you don't like this, but tell us what you think.
Well, so one of the first things...
Being a libertarian requires that you can see your government.
I think the last award was back when I was in the legislature, right, Brian?
John was... People don't... I remembered. I looked it up before I came over here. John was one of the leaders of GRAMA in his time in the legislature. And was the sponsor of the bill that was so controversial in 2011, HB 477. Uh-huh. And that... too long a story to go into here, but...
Yeah.
Well, that's consistent with what I would guess.
Yeah, part of that was trying to fine-tune and correct some issues and so forth. One of the key things is I think the press might be overreacting here. And as I mentioned before, the administrative law judge that's being put in place here, will that create more transparency and less transparency?
I don't know. Yeah, we don't know yet.
I think it's supposed to create more predictability, more consistency.
Maybe quicker?
Hopefully quicker.
Yeah.
But more or less, I don't know yet. And so we'll have to see. If it results in more transparency, then I think they were premature in giving this award. If it doesn't create more transparency, then they're justified in this award that they issued. The question will be, what is the right balance for transparency? How do we make it more predictable for the government? How do we make it more predictable for the public? How do we try and work towards a world in which I want to make it so it's just built into what government does, that they create transparency rather than all these extra hoops that are difficult for the public to access the information
they need? Fair enough.
And how quickly will the results be? Will requests for records be made and responses provided, and then an ultimate ruling if there's a disagreement from the administrative law judge? One of the things that people criticized the old process for was that it was too slow. And so I'd like to see an administrative law judge that is, of course, competent, good, makes wise decisions, and does it quickly in a transparent way. That would be the ideal, right? So we'll see.
And then the question is, will you get another one, two or three, depending on the workload flowing through?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So now we also have the Sundance Film Festival picking Boulder, Colorado for their new home and all
Rocky
the ramifications. Yeah, all the ramifications of that not being here. I just say from the political middle, from all my experience, I think that Sundance has lost its soul for this film festival to be so focused on the money.
Do you think that's what it is that caused them to leave?
I totally do, and I think they've said that. I mean, everyone wants to say it's because of, politics, but...
And I thought they lost their soul, but it was long before this.
Boulder put, let's round, but $34 million on the table. We put 3.2 over 10 years, but not guaranteed, but it was, gentleman's agreement kind of thing. I mean, I think we were incredibly competitive, but it wasn't guaranteed, and I think that was why. But I just think, what are they thinking?
Yeah.
To leave all the volunteerism, to leave a beautiful mountain town, all the incredible venues, all of the history. And I say lost their soul because independent filmmaking and being in this environment versus going to the echo chamber of Boulder, Colorado?
Well, the cultural climate is, it's hard for me to think that, I don't know who the decision makers were within Sundance who did this, but it's hard for me to believe that the cultural climate here in Utah, with the messaging that was coming out from the legislature year after year in a way that was counter to the feeling of a lot of folks in a more open cultural society such as Sundance is, didn't take a toll. Now, you can agree or disagree. I mean, I know that Dan McKay thinks it's great that they're leaving, but I would suggest that the benefit financially and economically to the state of Utah is significant, and this is a real loss to us. If you don't like what Sundance is peddling, nobody's forcing you to watch it. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that it put Utah on the map, not just nationally, but globally, in a way that I think brought a lot of good things to the state of Utah. You may not, like I say, like what everything that Sundance is peddling, although much of it is not objectionable to anybody in their right mind. But so don't watch it if you don't like it. Yeah. But to say that
but
it isn't helpful.
Subsidize it, please.
Well, I mean, look how much money they brought.
Let them do business. Don't let them do business. I don't think the taxpayers should be subsidizing one way or another, whether it's Sundance or various other things. I think we'd have a different outcome if Sundance was held at a different time than the legislative session. I've heard complaints over decades about the Sundance folks didn't like the message the legislature was doing. But, winter is what winter is.
Yeah. So we've got 1 minute left in the program. And let's just end by talking just a little bit about the Pride Flag bill. I want to thank Governor Cox for not signing the bill. He let it go into law without his signature and wrote a pretty direct letter on his no sign, essentially saying there's a better way we can both protect neutrality at public buildings and not hurt marginalized populations. We should have been more thoughtful in this, and we shouldn't be doing this on local government. So I want to thank Governor Cox for that. You guys, quick comment. Let's go to you, Brian, and then you'll finish us off.
Well, my only comment about Governor Cox is, and look, he vetoed a couple of terrible bills in a way that demonstrated some courage and spine, and I appreciated it. But I wish he hadn't just let this go into law without signing it. I wish he'd vetoed it.
Yeah, really quick here, John.
I like local control. I really want to drive it, but I want schools to be accountable to the local constituency, and too often they're not.
Very good.
And the legislature feels like they got to step in.
Well, that's a wrap. Thank you so much, Brian King, for joining us. John, appreciate your friendship and all. And I'm Natalie Gochner, programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.